Welcome back to the Thinking Minds podcast. My name's Alex. I'm a consultant psychiatrist. It's no secret that dating and relationships have become increasingly tumultuous in modern times, and many people are struggling in this area. With me today to talk about dating is Andrew Wilkinson, who's a men's dating coach and a YouTuber. Today we discuss all the problems of modern dating, including why Tinder is going to ruin your life, common problems both men and women have dating, the problem with being a quote nice guy, the looming difficulty of AI girlfriends, Andrew's own story and his path to becoming a dating coach, how people can think about relationships not just in terms of getting relationships but maintaining them in the medium to long term, and how you can think about your overall self-esteem beyond just your partner or your relationship. This is the Thinking Mind podcast, a podcast all about psychiatry, psychotherapy, self-development, and related topics. If you like it, there are a few ways you can support it. You can follow us on social media, share it with a friend, give us a rating on Apple, YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Or if you want to support the show further, you can check out the Buy Me a Coffee link in the description. Thanks for listening, and here's today's conversation with Andrew Wilkinson. Thanks for coming on the show.
Happy to be here.
Why is Tinder ruining people's dating lives?
So I have got quite a gripe with Tinder. I think it has caused a significant amount of damage. And one of the main ways that I think it's currently damaging is the fact that it's become the main way that men and women interact with each other. Because if you think now, how few interactions are you having in the real life? For a lot of men and a lot of women, the only way is through this, what I like to call like through the looking glass of Tinder. And this creates this like distortion field between us. And because of a few different factors, say like the anonymity of it, all it does is encourage like our worst behavior. That on one side, we have men that are probably not behaving in the best kind of fashion, sending unsolicited photos, sending messages that they shouldn't. And that's like the perception that women might start to get of men, because if they're not interacting in the real world with that many men in a romantic context, we start to believe what happens on Tinder is a reflection of reality. And men are on the other side of this, where they're truly struggling to find somebody. I work with clients, and I even know from my own dating history that when I was on Tinder, you were happy to get maybe two matches a week. And then this is creating this image for men that they feel like women are so selective that if you don't have a six pack, you're over 6 foot and you've got a six figure salary, you're not desirable. When this is simply put, just the effects of what a dating app does when a woman is inundated with infinite matches that she could attempt to go for. And it's just creating this force field between men and women, so they're not seeing the real gender that's on the other side, and it's causing this tension. And I think social media also supports that and pushes for it. So fundamentally, Tinder's biggest problem is that it has created this big force field around how we see the other gender. I have another two big blows, but
go on. Yeah, go for it.
I have this common line that I love to use of the fact that Tinder is just not like many other companies in how it operates. In that, I love the example of the simple like food truck. And I like to say that if you were to go up to a food truck, your goals and their goals are pretty aligned. You want to go up, you want to buy a tasty taco, they want to sell you a tasty taco. And then everybody's happy. That relationship, it can go. And everyone's coming out of that satisfied. Tinder, however, has a paradox in the sense that if they give you a match, they find someone for you that you could have a relationship with, that's what you're after. But if they give you that, they lose a customer, and not only one customer, they lose two. So as much as you're going on there trying to find that relationship, someone for you to have a truly rich experience with, if they give you that, they lose. So in order for Tinder to win, you have to lose.
How does Tinder do that? How does Tinder keep people, both men and women, on the apps?
They have some incredibly smart people, far smarter than myself, working on the algorithm for that. It's been specifically designed to feed you just enough matches and likes in order to keep you engaged enough that you can kind of chase the dragon to potentially buy premium, because that's all it is. It's a conveyor belt line to be able to get you to move along, to be chasing it of like, oh, I was so close. Maybe that girl would have liked me, but I'm not really making any matches anymore. And then they prompt you, Tinder Premium comes up, and it's like, would you like to buy this? Because they are a company. This isn't what Tinder was when it initially set out. Now it needs growth. It needs to hit shareholder targets. And the only way they do that is through getting Tinder Premium. The advertisements on it, it makes up such a small fraction of their total revenue. Don't think that just the people that are on there for free are contributing. It's not. It's highly supported by just people that are on in that 10% of people on the platform that pay for premium. They're what supports it, and they're what they want you to be.
Do you think Tinder is uniquely bad? Are all the dating apps like Hinge and Bumble, are they all similar in this respect? Because Hinge, its marketing strategy is based around the idea that we want you to get in a relationship and get off the app. So is it actually different, or is it just a marketing strategy in your view?
So it's a good question, because I do have a softer take. Let's say for Hinge, their tagline is that the dating app designed to be deleted. And there's a few things that they do which make it slightly better. So for anyone that's not used Hinge, the way that it differs from Tinder is that it isn't a swipe-based platform. It is one that takes that extra bit of effort, that you have to comment about something specific about their profile. Is it a particular photo? Is it a prompt they've done? And it causes you to just engage with that extra bit of effort, which I think does give it that advantage on Tinder. But there are still difficulties that come out of having any dating app downloaded in general. And one of the main ones, especially for the people that I work with, clients that I tell them, it takes away your agency and incentive to meet someone in the real world. Because why would you ever be brave enough to walk across the bar and say hi to someone when you've got that little voice in your head that can say, but we could just go swipe. That sounds nice. That sounds a bit safer. And that's the problematic thing of the dating apps. And I don't want to paint Tinder in this like absolute nefarious mode. I don't think they're just completely evil people. I think they're just in it for the profit and the gain, and people are pushing back more because if you're in for profit and gain in the realm of like relationships and love, like that's not going to go too well. People are going to push back against that. And whilst I think Tinder are especially the worst, it's definitely the worst, Hinge is better. You can find some success on there, and part of that is also down to the demographic breakdown. Hinge has a significantly more equal portion of men to women. So Hinge operates at something closer to about 62 to 65% female, 35% male, whilst Tinder is catastrophically way more male. Pre-pandemic in the UK, it was 85% male. I think the pandemic encouraged a few more people to, well, a few more women to jump on because it was the only option, but they hate to release this data. They don't want you to know this. But it's still hovering around the 75% mark. So 3 men for every 1 woman on there. And that's why Hinge is a bit better, because just because simple supply and demand economics, you have a better chance of meeting somebody. But you're still playing a rigged game.
And talking about those statistics reminded me of something, an idea that I heard, that really the economics of a dating app is very similar to the economics of your average nightclub. So the way nightclubs function, the way they make money, is based on having single women that regularly go to that nightclub. That's what makes a nightclub cool or relevant or attractive, desirable. To go yeah. to, desirable. And that essentially a nightclub will have a typical arc, a typical life, you know, it'll peak when it's populated by a lot of single women and lots of guys there. If I want to go, then it'll have a decline. And then the girls move to the new nightclub that's more popular and that will take all the men. And I've heard that dating apps essentially operate in a similar way. Obviously, Tinder was first on the scene, but now perhaps we're seeing that Tinder is in its decline phase.
Yeah, I think Tinder certainly is in the decline phase. They reported that for like the fifth quarter in a row, they've got like decreased subscribers. So I think this is the advantage of the free market, that if you fail to deliver what you say you're going to long enough, people will look elsewhere. I will say, because I think it's a good comparison, by the way, to the nightclub. There is one way that it differs, and I think this is what leads to a lot more of the negative mental health outcomes from it. That if you walk into that nightclub, you see a sea full of people, and you can get a general judge on if there's significantly more men or significantly more women. If you go on a dating app, what do you see? You just see a sea of the other gender, and it feels like all there is you and all of them. And that's why it's so devastating to a guy when he's walked in there, because it feels like he's the only guy in the club and there's hundreds of women and none of them want him because he didn't see the cues of other guys that are there. And that's why they're so nefarious, because they make you feel like you're in the right place when you're just not.
And that's a really important point. Now, let's flip that around. What do women see on a dating app?
I think there's significant and equal challenges for women on a dating app. I've been fortunate enough to sort of see it on the other side of how dating apps work for women. They've shown me. And it's just the sea of likes. And it's so challenging because it creates this feedback loop of when there's so many men just sending likes their way. It's overwhelming. And it leaves them in a position where they have to make such a big decision off such little information. One of the ways that dating apps fall down for women is that it doesn't display male attractiveness very well. Like, what can you tell about a guy from a photo? It's like, how smart is he? How witty is he? Is he confident? Is he charismatic?
Everything can be fixed.
Yeah, exactly. They don't know. And it's such an important decision for a woman to make if she's going to go out on a date with a guy, and she's having to essentially do it blind whilst also being just sent an insane amount of contacts and likes. It's like, it's the paradox of choice as well. It's like, how do you know you're going to pick the right one? She's going to be in a position where she will never feel like she selected the right guy, because there's always another one, there's always someone else. And it creates its own problem as well, because there's so many options. Women get more selective with what they choose, but then because women are being more selective, men send more likes to try and get them to pick them, and it just creates this never-ending feedback loop. So neither side are happy here, and neither side are being serviced very well. And to refer back to that earlier point, it just descends into showing the worst sides of both of us.
Absolutely. One of the things I worry about with the ubiquity of dating apps is that not only is it becoming more convenient to meet people online, but it's becoming almost like the only socially acceptable option. And you really saw this during COVID as well, because obviously during COVID, it was no longer morally acceptable to go to talk to people in public because of social distancing.
Yeah.
And that's very strange when you think about how just in the 1990s, when online dating would have started, it was seen as really strange and it was taboo. And now it's become like the main way. And one thing I worry about is that it's going to become really the only acceptable way, because everything else would be seen as either toxically masculine or too intrusive. And of course, there are ways to meet people. There are ways to meet people which don't have to be toxic, which can still be very respectful. Can you comment on what's the value for men to experience rejection, do you think?
Humongous. It's absolutely huge. And as you were speaking there, I really did want to put forward that despite the fact we feel like times have changed so much and you can't go over and you can't do this, you can't do that, there are all these restrictions around them, women don't want to be approached. And all this feeling and the sentiment that's been created, as you say, to the idea that Tinder and dating apps are the only way to meet girls, That's not been my lived experience, and it's not been that of my clients either. That there are still plenty of ways to meet girls. That the girl that I'm in a relationship with right now, I met because I went to a city center. I saw her, I walked across and said, "Hi, you look awesome. What's your name?" And from that simple interaction, we've then gone on to have a full relationship, and that's still alive. The fact are, the rules never changed as much as we like to think they did. If you're polite and you go across and you just present and show yourself of like, "Hi, I'd like to get to know you," and give them the option, women love that. I think there's data on this as well, that women between the ages of 18 to 30, 77% of them wish they were approached more. Like, there is still this desire amongst people to connect in this way, and for men to go through that process, as you say, to experience a rejection is massive. I think I've done over 1,000 approaches in my life where I've walked up, and this doesn't stay isolated to that one area of life. It gives you the confidence to go through that. Yeah, you take the rejection and the world doesn't crumble around you. And to anyone that's sat there listening to this and is scared of the idea to go speak to a girl, of all the things that could happen, I've done 1,000 and I've never had anything bad happen to me. I've gone, the worst thing that happens to you is I've gone over and said hi. She just kept on walking by. And I'm just like, "Oh, I'm invisible. Oh no." And she's just kept on going. Like, as long as you present yourself in just a polite, forthright manner, it's not going to go wrong. We hear these horror stories that get put out on the largest scale on the internet, of where the woman starts screaming and it goes awfully wrong for the guy. And it's, of course, they're what go big on the internet because they're clickable. And that's all we see. We see those clickable headlines of the one time where a guy just makes an awful approach, it goes completely wrong. We don't get to see the nuance of what happened. We just see the result because it was an extreme result. And for guys, I think it's one of the most powerful things that they can ever learn, is to be able to go through that process of walking over and trying to create an interaction.
Can I make an assumption, Andrew?
Yes, sure.
My assumption is, when your girlfriend tells her family and friends about the way that you met, that in general, they're either really impressed or really jealous.
You know, that's a really good assumption. That's what it is. She's really excited. I remember she told her mum really early on of how we met, because I was curious whether she would. Like, I was like interested to say, "Did you describe it exactly how it was, that I walked over, you didn't know me?" And she was just excited to do it because people love the story. And that's what it is for me, of like the dating app thing, that in this life, we get one run around this thing, that you get to find one partner and you have an amazing time with, like, that closest person to you. And you're going to then defer that to an app. You're going to give it to an algorithm to find that. I hate the idea of that. I want to live this life the best that I can. And that includes being able to have the girl that I want to pick and the one that I want to walk up to. And I'm not like, "Hey, grandchild, you want to know how we met?" I sat on my ass swiping away, and luckily she swiped back. Like, what story is that?
It sounds pretty dystopian, to be honest.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, let's wind the clock back a bit. Tell me a bit about where you started. You weren't always a dating coach. Things were harder for you in the past. So how did this start, and then how did you get to the point that you're at now?
Okay, well, I made the completely normal transition from being an accountant to being a relationship coach, but we'll fill in some of the gaps between there. Growing up for me, it was not good. I was severely bullied. I didn't have a girlfriend at all. Girls were not interested in me, and that sucks, because the thing that I wanted most in the world when I was 14 was to have a girlfriend. And I could see all my friends and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. Why was no one interested in me? There must be something wrong with me. And that took me a long time to try and process that. I had to grow up through that. And at 18 years old, I was still struggling. Like, full disclosure, I lost my virginity at like 22. I was like, for me, I never sort of felt sort of desired. And I went away and I worked on myself, because I think you have two options. At that point, when maybe the world isn't giving you exactly what you want. And you can either decide that, oh, it's my fault, it's never going to change, I can't do anything about it. Or what I literally thank every heavens till the end of time, my opinion was, okay, let's go fix this. And that took some time. That took me developing myself as a person. And that was what I spent a lot of my teenage years and early 20s doing. And that means, yeah, helping sort your physical body out, getting in shape. But a lot of it's just doing the emotional work, having real, honest relationships with your friends, not being someone that's lying to himself and others. That I went through all that process. And then I got to sort of 22 years old and just noticed that I was starting to get a lot more interest. Then I did the typical thing as a guy of like, you've never had any interest. Then you start to get some. I fell madly in love with the first girl that I had a decent relationship with. And I had a great relationship with her until the end. And it did the typical thing. It exploded. And I went through that grieving process of feeling devastated. But then I carried on. And at this point, I was still in finance. But I realized that I had this calling to help others, that I spent too much time just with my forehead on the desk to stay in finance because it was making me miserable. So after I'd found a way to sort of develop myself, that I'd gone from someone that I felt was completely undesirable, really struggled with any kind of connection with friends, with girls, just I really struggled in every realm. And I spent about a decade fixing all that. And then I noticed the weirdest things started to happen, and the people that I was friends with around me started to go through the same process, and I was able to help them with it. So I initially quit finance and I started a company where I was helping people as a quote unquote performance coach. And I worked with people to help develop. Some of them were like high achievers in business, people were striving to work for Google, and we'd work together. And over time, I just realized that the clients I had the most success with, the best time with, it was always the ones that wanted to talk about relationships and wanted to develop themselves in that realm. So I took this journey from going from being sort of a data analytical guy, and I was like, I'll come in, I'll check through all your data, we'll see how you can improve and perform, to this slow journey to where I just ended up, okay, relationships it is. And it's where my heart is. It's what drove me. I know for a fact that younger me, the driving force of why he wanted to be that better person was the fact that he didn't want to be single for the rest of his life.
It's a very interesting story. That common arc, that hero's journey. And one thing I'm curious about is, you know, we often start out on journeys like that because we want the end result. So a guy might be lonely and want a girlfriend, or a girl might be lonely and want a boyfriend, and they might start out on a journey because they want that end result. But in your experience, is it about the end result, or is it about the process and the new person that you very slowly, very incrementally, but very consistently become in order to get that result?
Yeah, 100%. It's like, it's not about the destination. It's not even about the journey. It's about the person you become along the way in the journey. I know it's somewhat cliche and trite, but it's simply true. We operate at our best when we have a target, but it's not all about that. It's like, have a target, have an aim, because otherwise you're probably going to be sat in your basement eating Cheetos till like you're 45. Actually having the motivation to get out there and do something is huge, but it's never going to be the be all end all.
And speaking of motivation, do things like AI girlfriends, which are already a thing, if you guys aren't aware, AI girlfriends are a thing, or in the future, sex robots or artificial girlfriends and boyfriends, does stuff like that worry you?
They terrify me, because I think it was so easily adopted, the generation of OnlyFans and pornography, that things that came in, that is going to be super desirable for a guy. The only thing that's going to hold it back is the fact that it's quite low status, that if you're walking around with your AI girlfriend, is probably not something that you're going to immediately tell to your friends. But the thing is, it's going to be convenient. And speaking from experience, like, I've seen it, there are guys that are truly lonely out there, and if there's something or someone that can offer them that sense of connection, that's what the human strives for more than anything in the world. Like, we want that sense of connection. And if the world has blocked it in every other avenue, I'm sure that AI girlfriends will sweep in there and be able to fill that gap. And it scares me, because men can do so much better, and we have a bad tendency to default to the easiest option. And I can't think of a more easy and convenient option than the AI girlfriend.
And I guess it could just very easily go through that same transition that Tinder went through, or online dating went through, from being very socially taboo to being acceptable to being the main option. It could be maybe in 50 years, AI girlfriends will be the main option, and it'll be a bit unusual actually to have a real life partner.
Yeah, why not? You get to customize them completely to your taste. You never have to have an argument. Here's the reason that they'll be so successful, and it's already the reason why pornography is so successful. You will never have to be vulnerable. And that's the thing that scares people the most in relationships now. That's why relationships are starting to wane, because you actually have to show yourself, and you can be rejected and you can fail. It's why so many young guys actually are turning to pornography as almost preference to a real life girlfriend, because it's always safe. There's this beautiful girl who's always there for him. Doesn't matter if he fails to perform or anything like that. He's safe and secure. But if he interacts with a real girl, have a real relationship, you're putting yourself out there where you could get hurt. And that's where AI girlfriends will step in, and they'll steal away those people that have that fear around being seen and to be vulnerable.
Thinking about this with my psychotherapy brain, what I think is going to happen, and what I think will give AI girlfriends, sex robots, an edge over things like pornography and OnlyFans, is that you'll be able to program in just the right amount of friction, actually just the right amount of arguments, actually the kind of skill set that would be required to get a guy or a girl to be vulnerable. I actually think they're going to be able to simulate people well enough to create that experience that's not exactly idyllic, because people do have a desire for chaos. They have a desire for destruction. They have a desire for chaotic emotions as much as they do for stability. So I think what's really nefarious is they're going to make them uncannily lifelike, program in just the right amount of arguments and be able to do it, to tailor it individually to each person, and then provide the relief after each argument. That is what I would worry would make it truly, truly addictive.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I'd not considered that from the sense that people usually lean towards going to the easiest option, but you could be right that the ability to have them dialed into exactly the specification you could want, to have those post-argument reconciliation moments of elation, that makes it even more scary.
It's like gambling. So gambling works like this. So gambling involves a bit of friction. What makes gambling so addictive is the unpredictability of the rewards. So there's some vulnerability in the mammalian brain where obviously any kind of reward is addictive, but a reward that's unpredictable in just the right ratio is extremely addictive. They've proven this on mice. So essentially the technical word for gambling is variable ratio conditioning, which means you attach a reward to a particular action, but you vary the ratio. Rather than make it 1:1, you might make it 1:3, but in a way that's unpredictable. And then when you have mice run these kinds of protocols, what you find is they get the highest dopamine spikes, say, and that's what makes it uniquely addictive. If they program that into an artificial partner, then we're done.
Yeah, they could be infinitely addictive, and that is scary, because it's the same way that they use your likes getting delivered on Tinder, that if everything you swiped was a like, you wouldn't be interested. That's why they feather them in for that variable reward ratio schedule.
Absolutely, yeah. So if a guy, your average guy, comes to you and they want to work on their dating and their relationships, what are the kind of steps you take them through?
Well, it's always unique to the guy, because I found that whilst there are some commonalities, everyone's particular situation is significantly different. I tend to break it down of having a look and identifying where he's falling down. And I break it into three categories, and they're a little bit trite, but we're going to go for it. So one of the first ways that a guy could be falling down is the most obvious and the one that everyone sort of jumps to think to when things aren't working well. And I refer to it as bad product, that maybe you just haven't got the best product that you're showing to the world. Maybe you've never left home and you don't have a job and all these things. And if I'm honest, this almost never comes up. I think the wave of self-development, the Jordan Peterson 2017 era, got a lot of guys into a position where they're not actually bad guys. They've got a lot going for them. The product they're offering to the world is quite good. So then I look at the next step and I call this bad marketing. And it's like, you might be quite an attractive guy. You might be quite interesting. You would be shocked how many guys that have a lot going for them are quite interesting and attractive, still have awful times trying to meet women. And I put that down to the fact that they just have awful marketing, because I ask them, it's like, okay, so how many women that you don't know do you meet each week, and how many do you meet? And they're just like, oh, I know like two girls from the office and they both have a boyfriend. And I'm just like, cool, where are we expecting this relationship to come from? And that's what we have. We have such awful visibility because we decided, in modern day, we traded frequency of interactions with others for convenience. That, why would you need to go to Blockbuster? Here's Netflix. Why would you need to go out for a meal? Here's Uber Eats. In an attempt to reduce the friction of life, we got rid of those random passive interactions that used to be such a hotbed for people to interact with each other. And then looking and identifying this is a key area of just being like, okay, how can we get you in a position where you're actually able to show who you are and meet more girls? And one thing that can be done is through approaching, meeting people. Also can be just putting themselves out into the world. But we're not done yet, because you do meet some guys and they can be like really attractive, really fun guys, and they actually meet quite a few girls. But then enters the final category, which is what I call bad ethos. And this is the people that have self-sabotaging habits. Maybe they've got a bit of the nice guy syndrome going on and they've just got attachment issues. And that's where we'd look to address some of these and identify what is it that's going on. Are you particularly avoidant? Do you deliberately go for the wrong type of people that you eventually reject yourself from? Is it being too much of a nice guy when you present yourself? Do you have an inability to put boundaries and tell the truth? What I've found is it takes away a little bit of the edge when you're discussing with someone. If you're just like, ah, dude, it's okay. Like, your marketing's just a bit funky. Let's have a look and work with this. And it will be one of those three categories. And that's what I work through with guys. I figure out what's going wrong. Is there something that you could do to improve? I would say it often comes down to the second two. It's very rarely that I'm like having to work with a guy to improve himself in such a manner, because at the point that they're reaching out, they're likely someone that's got some agency about them who've improved. It's more down to the fact that they're still carrying this insecurity. They feel like they're not worthy of love. And we're looking into those deeper issues of, I know one guy specifically, I was working with him this weekend just gone, and he has really sort of severe social anxiety. Like, he really struggled one of the early weeks just to sort of get a feel for where he was at. I was like, okay, your objective this week, just give out one compliment to someone. And he went out onto a high street for 3 hours and wasn't able to do it and just came back home. And that was just because he had this fundamental belief it was not okay for him to give out a compliment. He's not worthy to do that. And that's really tough. So instead, since I realized there was a bit of this blockage, what we did this Sunday just gone was I timed it. I was like, okay, what are you up to at 6 p.m.? And we both went out. I went out because he's in another country. I went out to the town near me and he went out into his city center, and I got to show him how I operate. Of just being able to be someone that I refer to as like an agent of connection. I will walk down a high street and I'll make eye contact. I'll say hi. I'll wave. I'll be like, cool jacket. And just getting into that mode of being someone that has connection with others. We're so shut off. And that causes so many problems that you can't just go from being that insular person that never interacts to then suddenly jumping forward and being like, hi there, I'd like to date you. It doesn't work like that. So what we did, I showed him just on video. I was going around saying hi. And I was like, cool, your turn. So whilst he was out in the city centre, he had his sort of phone with him and the camera on. I was in his ear and I was just like, hey, what about that person? Say hi. Because he fundamentally believed you needed a reason to say hi to somebody. And I was like, no, dude, you can say hi. It's completely okay. You will likely make that day because everyone else is lonely. So go over and say hi. And it took, I think, about 15 minutes of us being on the call where he just couldn't quite do it. And then he finally got the first one. Someone came past. They were wearing it, earphones, and they kept walking. But I was like, you did it, dude. I was so excited for him. And then 5 minutes later, he got his second hi. And then he got 10 more over the next sort of 5 minutes. And then I was like, okay, dude, I'm out. See if you can get five more whilst I'm gone. And he did. And that's what we'll do. We'll build up his ability to speak to people, and he's feeling more confident. We did so many micro actions in the weeks leading up to it, and then to help him feel like he has something to offer the world.
I don't think women realize how much of a deep-seated fear the majority of men have when it comes to talking to women in a romantic context. And I think that's primarily because most girls and women go through their whole lives occasionally being hit on by guys who are maybe a bit sleazier, maybe guys who lack empathy, maybe guys who are quite intrusive. And so they think men are like that in general, and because men are less risk averse in general, that's not really a problem. But actually what they're seeing is a tiny, tiny slice of the male population, and that most guys, and particularly the guys very often that they would want to date, guys that have empathy, guys that have the skills to build a good relationship because they are like that, they actually don't really want to intrude on a woman's space, and often they can feel quite afraid of doing so. But why do you think that this is such a deep-seated fear that men have?
I certainly agree. There's a selection bias between the guy that's more likely to go over and approach versus the guy that maybe is more softer-hearted, that doesn't want to intrude and be difficult. But this fear for men, it strikes so deeply within their core that I remember reading stories of just like fighter pilots that would go off, risk their lives on missions, that would then come back to a local bar and their friends would be like, why don't you speak to her? And they'd be like, no, I can't do this. Like, it isn't a measure of just like sheer bravery. It's something that's really embedded into us, that fear of rejection. It's builds up more and more, because often the ones with the most fear are the ones that have never done it, because once you encounter the problem, the fear starts to dissipate a lot more and it starts to shrink. And it's the fear of the unknown which really hurts men. And it's the social rejection, it's the status hit that he could suffer. I think it's, they reviewed it and it's like men are 5 times more scared of the social repercussions than the legal repercussions of going over and approaching.
Yeah, I also think there might be a deeper evolutionary reason, like something about, I suspect in our evolutionary past, approaching people you didn't know in general is going to be a dangerous prospect because they're not in your group and you don't know if they're violent, you don't know if there's a war between your tribes, you don't know if something's going to happen. And then I think approaching an attractive member of the opposite sex in our ancestral environment is an extremely risky proposition because you don't know who that person is associated with. If they're associated with a male in the other tribe who might be stronger than you, who might be 3 feet taller than you, it might, could have been a very dangerous prospect back then. You know, I'm talking about thousands of years ago. And I wonder if there's still something baked into our brains, you know, along those lines.
Yes, we have not changed that much in the time in between then. We still operate with very much the same sort of software and hardware that's just coded into us from that time. And it definitely was more risky. I think the social rejection was higher when the community was super tightly knit, that everyone would know, say, this person that you've gone up to has rejected you, and then that may impact your chances of further mating success. And I think that's how guys see it, that if I'm to get rejected by this girl, it would plummet my ability to potentially have mating success in the future if she says no.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even within your group, it's a problem because, like you said, we were very, very reputational, and obviously we still are within our groups, and that it could, you know, for you to approach someone badly and to make a mess of it would be this like statement that then you have to carry around with you for the rest of your life.
100%. I think that's the fear. It's the fear that it will never leave them, that it will be scarring them for the rest of their life, that if they go up and make this error. And yeah, I get we live in the age of the sort of digital media of if you go over and make it, I will live forever on the internet. It's not what I've seen. What happens, these are fears that get propagated by social media.
Yeah. Now, the way you work with guys, and the way you work is really you want guys to get into like a good relationship. You're not the kind of dating coach that's about encouraging guys to just sleep with as many women as possible. And I think that's cool because I think, you know, relationships and families are so important, obviously, for our society. It feels like that's almost a controversial thing to say nowadays, that families are important for society, but they're super important, and you don't have to be super traditional to think that. But regardless, once a guy is in a relationship, what are the common problems they might face, and how should they think about those problems?
So I think one of the most common problems for guys is the one that works super hard to get into the relationship, but once he has the relationship, feels like he can take the foot off the gas, that maybe now he quote-unquote got the girl, he was really in a big pursuit to get the girl, then it starts to crumble after that. But to me, it always comes down to that sense of felt connection between the two of you. I don't know how familiar you are with the Dr. John Gottman and his emotional bids.
Oh, yeah.
And how he was able. Yeah. For anyone listening, they brought in couples and they were able to review them on sort of cameras that they set up and ask them a bunch of questions about their relationship, how they met. And then they put them into an apartment called the Love Lab. And they were just able to watch them to see maybe what was going on and which of these couples, when they checked in 6 years later, they broke them into two different categories, the sort of the masters and the not so masters, let's say, the ones that had broken up or were in a really unhappy relationship. And it seems to distill down to, are you willing to be receptive to those emotional bids from a partner, where an emotional bid can be, hey, look at that interesting thing out the window. Hey, look at this meme on my phone. Or even just reaching out to grab their hand. And that's what it seems to distill down to. It always seems to be based on attention. They check to see if it was like the depth of conversation or anything other of the variable factors between the couple that kept them together. And it didn't seem to be that at all. It was simply, do you still put your attention on your partner? And I think this is where we all fall down. That once we start to get comfortable with someone, we start to feel like maybe we know them, maybe the novelty has started to wear off. We start to put our attention elsewhere. And in modern day, that's never been easier to just get distracted. If you want to maintain your relationship, pay attention to your partner, because they will tell you exactly what they want from you if you just pay attention to them. If they want closeness, if they want distance, they will start to show that. The reason relationships break down is because there is this lack of communication, and it's not always verbal, it's being able to see your partner. And the moment you start looking elsewhere, that's when things fall apart.
Yeah, and I think you raise good points, and what they underscore is the idea that a relationship isn't something you get, like you get a car and then you have a car, and that's as straightforward as that. A relationship is built and then maintained, and it's like rebuilt sort of in small ways every day. And one of the ways you build your relationship is, of course, with your attention, with responding to bids, as you say, and then remaining, I think, a dynamic, vibrant creature yourself, so that you remain more interesting. Hopefully the other person is also doing the same. And then just not falling into that trap of feeling like you know everything about them, which is an illusion that it's very easy to fall into, this idea that, oh, I've been with them X amount of years, I know everything about them, I can predict everything they're going to say. And it's like, if you interact with them in a predictable way, they will interact with you back in a predictable way. You create kind of that relationship environment that would evoke either novelty or stability or stagnation. And I think this is how affairs happen, essentially, because people fall into a rut of stagnation where they feel like they can only be really one way with each other and there's no novelty. And then, let's say, the guy meets a girl that makes them feel like they can be different, that makes them feel vital again. Or the same thing could happen to a woman who meets a man that feels, that makes them feel like they can step into a new role all of a sudden for the first time in 20 years. And then that kind of spark, it's very seductive, obviously. It's very hard to resist. So really, you really want to be proactive about that and keep a spark of novelty alive between the two of you as much as possible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think pursuing that ability for you to be that ever-changing creature that is of interest. And one note I would add as well, maintaining your social relationship seems to be a huge cue for the success of your relationship. If you don't have anyone else to turn to, if they are then made to fill every role, they have to be your best friend, they have to be your confidant in every single format, that becomes challenging and puts a lot of pressure on the relationship. And it's difficult to be novel if all of the inputs are the same person. So if I'm only ever interacting with you, we've almost got a closed loop of an ecosystem. But as soon as you've got all these other people in your network, you have these other people you're interacting with, and it allows you to become novel. Because I absolutely agree that that's what people look for in the affairs. They're looking for that novelty, they're looking for that change. They want, we're so like four-dimensional, we have so many sides to ourselves, it can be so frustrating if we're just only able to express this one side of us. We want to be able to be multifaceted, and that's the issue with a relationship that errs too hard on the comfortability side, that we need to have that dynamism between us. I loved your point as well, by the way, of if you interact in a novel manner, you will encourage them to almost mirror back to you in a novel manner. I'd never considered that, so that's really cool.
Yeah, it's a dynamic, you know, relationships are a dynamic thing. You will usually get back what you bring. And of course, if they don't do that, for example, you know, if you bring honesty, that will generally encourage honesty back. So being honest in a small way, someone else might be honest in a small way back. And if they don't do that, then that's a sign that maybe it's time to leave that relationship, because ultimately what relationships boil down to is like long-term reciprocal interactions. I give you something you want, you give me something I want. A classic win-win exchange. And so one of the ways that's good to test, you know, whether a relationship is actually viable is, you know, when I earnestly, sincerely, honestly tell my partner what they want in a way that's respectful and do my very best to give them what they say they want, are they able to engage with that process over the days, months, years? And if they're not, then there might be an issue, and that might be a reason that the relationship has to end. But yeah, absolutely. You definitely, most of the time, I think you get what you give. I mean, similar with your philosophy about finding a girlfriend, you know, for a man to find a girlfriend, they need to be able to comfortably, respectfully express their sexuality. Sexuality is a very dangerous thing. It's not something that you express lightly. It's hard to express. It's hard to get that balance right. It's a bit like when people learn to drive a car, what they do, they press the accelerator really hard and then they press the brake really hard and the car kind of jerks. But that's what you need, is you need that balance of, for both men and women, how do you get that balance between expressing sexuality but then holding back when it's necessary, to create that tension, to create that kind of sense of aliveness?
Such a good point, man, of being able to express sort of your sexuality. It's tough, and I think that the metaphor of the car is exactly on point, that it kind of takes testing, that you don't just magically suddenly be able to express yourself in that way just overnight. And a lot of guys will hold themselves back because they just select these areas of themselves that aren't acceptable. Let's say something that I find common with men is they'll start to reject maybe some of their feminine sides, surprisingly, that they feel like it's unacceptable to be expressive and feminine. And then because they create this blockage here, it often leads to other blockages elsewhere, because as soon as you say that this part of you is unacceptable, you can't express this, then you start to put walls around and that doesn't allow you to be able to express your desire properly. I think the way that we view masculinity and femininity is really wrong, that we often see it like a scale, that if you're to do more of one, it reduces from the other. But to me, the way that I express it to my clients and what I've seen, it's almost like they're two individual bars, that you can either be really good and really skilled in your masculine and really good and skilled in your feminine, or you can be a kind of useless in both, that you're not able to express yourself in a particularly masculine manner or in a feminine, because there are a bunch of amazing qualities for a guy that he can pick up in their feminine. I'm personally not the most hyper-masculine man in every different way. It's like, I like Taylor Swift. I can beat for beat sing all of Call Me Maybe. Like, and being able to sort of accept this is one of the things that allowed me to project my intentions and wants into the world and my desires, because it made me okay with the person that's projecting it. And if you're not okay with that person and you haven't integrated these weird, funky habits and things that you're interested in, it becomes more difficult to project, say, sexual desire, because that's likely one of the ones deepest lurking in your shadow.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you, you mentioned self-esteem earlier. Can you comment on using your dating life and your relationship life to fix your self-esteem? Is that a fool's errand, do you think? Is self-esteem something kind of a little bit untouchable by our external circumstances, or what has it been like for you?
So this is a good question, because you're speaking to someone who had rock bottom self-esteem growing up and had to go on a bit of a journey. From what I've found, it's very difficult to touch your self-esteem through just pure introspection. What I've found is it's going out into the world and doing the things that scare me. It's, I don't know how familiar you are with the Knights of the Round Table story of going for the Holy Grail, but it's super short.
And the Monty Python version.
I don't know the Monty Python, I'm a bit on the younger side for that, but I do know that when they were in a castle, that King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table were all together and they were sat around and they were in pursuit of the Holy Grail. And they were in a castle in the center of a deep wood. So they had no idea where to go to find the Holy Grail, but they all set out and they looked into the woods, and each night started where the wood looked darkest to them. And the idea is that the thing that is most desired and the most powerful thing for you is to be found where you least want to look. And I can absolutely say that where a lot of my self-esteem came from was putting myself in positions where I was willingly going to encounter some particularly difficult stuff. For example, I went on a 10-day silent meditation retreat, and at the time I didn't meditate. It was one of the most grueling, painful experiences I've ever done. But when I'm now in that position where I'm like, ooh, can I go on that podcast that I've been invited to? Can I go across and approach the girl? You stand on your stack of wins. And that's the difficult thing with self-esteem. It's the leap of faith that you get the courage from doing the act. You don't get it before. And that's the pain. That's the paradox. You get the self-esteem, you get the courage and all that after the fact. And so many people don't get on that conveyor belt that could take them somewhere amazing, because that first leap of faith, they're not willing to take it. And that's, so for reference with that client that I worked with on Sunday, he took his first leap of faith when he was willing to say hi to those people on the street and push himself out of that. We had a call this week and he was so excited about how it went, and he's now gearing himself up to go again. And the thing is, his self-esteem is better now than it was before, but it's because he did the difficult thing.
Yeah, because he doesn't have a girlfriend.
No, he doesn't have a girlfriend yet. And I think that's it. Tying your entire self-esteem to a relationship will likely doom it, because if you won't be okay if she leaves, she likely will, because you're going to act in ways that are irrational and needy. And that's one of the worst things that a guy can do, is be someone that's truly needy, that, oh my God, you can never leave me. I'll never be okay without you because my entire bedrock of self-esteem relies on you validating me that I'm okay. It will doom the relationship. So if you use that of I'll be okay once I have a girlfriend, it's truly dangerous as a mindset.
What are you specialize in men, but what are some of the problems, common problems you think women experience with dating and relationships?
I think it's super challenging. They're still in the same field of the fact that we don't encounter that many people in real life. They live in the digital world, and it's the inability to trust that for women, when they're trying to figure out who is trustworthy, when the majority of your interactions are based online initially, whether another common way is like, oh, they message them on a date, social media, you can be a completely different person over text. And that's the risk that they have to play. And we're all becoming super risk averse. And that's for girls, they're going on a date with a guy that they don't know in some of these instances. And that's super risky. And I think any girl that turns up on a date is just brave because like that's such an amazing act that you've done. You've gone and put yourself out there and it's incredible, but we don't particularly reward that all the time. And if you're looking for someone that you should engage with, because let's take this back, let's say sort of 50, 60 years ago when a girl was considering like, oh, that guy over there seems kind of interesting. What's she able to do? She's able to speak to her entire network where they start to get stories about, oh, is this guy a decent guy? They're able to fill in that picture of who he was. And then I think for girls, they've got to face the fact that too many young men are also caught in the pornography loop, which is pretty devastating for young women, that men are now just so zonked out of their entire relationship with the sexual and dating world has often been done through a screen since they were 14. So there's this mismatch of expectations. It leads to, once again, that inability to be vulnerable, which can lead to a bunch of issues in the bedroom. And I think pornography also creates that novelty that we were speaking about previously, where too many girls find themselves with a guy that they think are great. And then it turns out that maybe he's got like a raging porn addiction.
Yes. And these are all the newer problems, I think, that women are facing, which are very important. But if you'll indulge me, I'd like to comment on, I think, the archetypal classic problem that I think women face when it comes to men. Because you know, through women in my personal life, it's not articulated enough. And this is something I would want more women to be aware of. I guess you could call this mansplaining, but the problem is this. Women want a man who is capable of taking risks, who is assertive, who is in some sense subtle or less subtle, dangerous. Women also want a man who is compassionate and who can take care of them and who will be protective. Women often fall into the false dichotomy of thinking those are two separate categories with no overlap. Either I will date the man who I am physically attracted to, who is dangerous, risk-taking, this so-called bad boy, or I'm going to date the guy who is clearly, let's say, a better decision pragmatically, but I'm not that attracted to. And it's gonna fizzle out and the relationship is going to lack chemistry. I think what's worth realizing is that you're looking for the center of the bullseye. So you're looking for the guy that has both of those qualities. And it's not that they don't exist. It's that they're rare. And that because of the way that society and modernity has moved and the ways we've kind of outlined, it's becoming rarer because the way norms and ethics are changing, as we mentioned earlier, guys that have a tendency to be a bit more empathic are becoming less and less assertive. And so you're getting less of that bullseye of the guy who's both capable of being a compassionate, you know, basic good human being, is going to be less willing to assert their sexuality. And that's kind of a problem. Is this something you've observed in your work?
So, yeah, I'm definitely familiar with this. I've heard it referred to. It's like, women want a guy that's kind of monstrous enough to keep the monsters away, but not monstrous enough that he's going to be horrible to her or any other potential people they might have in their family. And it's that super fine line that they're trying to find in the world. And yeah, to speak to what you said, I think the sensitive type are getting significantly less assertive because it's been kind of ruled that any display of masculinity could be perceived quite easily as bad, wrong, despite the fact that tastes haven't changed. The fact that if you're able to be actually confident in your masculinity in a true and honest fashion, telling the truth when it's difficult to do that is a show of strength. And I think, because we're tiptoeing close to the whole Andrew Tate issue where it's like, oh, it's the vision of what a 13-year-old thinks masculinity is. So it's like, we're not after that. We're after that balance, the guy that can play both sides. And it's kind of what I referred to earlier of the guy that can operate really well in his masculine and really well in his feminine, that they aren't, this isn't some seesaw effect. It's a, to use a gaming reference, it's like a skill bar to increase on both. And I think every guy has his natural default position for where he should start with. And I personally started with being quite comfortable, of like compassionate and all these things. And I had to work really hard to be someone that is able to be assertive, to say no when no needs to be said. And I think that's why the message sometimes gets lost, because it's a different message depending on the guy. I've met plenty of guys that maybe are a little bit too far on the assertive and don't have that gentle part of the gentleman. And then you meet plenty of guys that are on the gentle side and they're being told not to be a man because the advice that's being given for the other people that are a bit more boisterous is filtering onto them. And it's just, it's an issue of a general sort of blanket statement of advice being given to all men that are operating on a very different part of that sort of spectrum between masculinity and femininity.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point. Blanket advice that's just not tailored to the individual with, I think, huge consequences potentially. Now you've worked on dating and relationships in your own life a lot. Where has self-development taken you since then? What are the kind of challenges you face since and that you face now?
The challenges in my own personal life?
Yeah.
I think one of the challenges that I'm facing right now is after growing up and being someone that was very afraid to be seen because it felt like they were badly bullied for the aspects that made them unique. I think this is something that people all share, that maybe it's likely the things that made you unique growing up that were picked on and bullied for. And it encourages you to maybe hide those and try and normalize who you are. Well, I now have a YouTube channel which exposes every side of me. So I always have this internal battle of being able to show who I am truly and be seen by the world whilst I still have that voice inside me that reminds me when I was young that if you chose to express who you really were, that was dangerous. That gave people ammunition. You could be taken down. I think the ability to be truly vulnerable and honest is a skill that people really undervalue. That us, we're not encouraged for this at all. It's all about the most beautiful moment of your life that you put on social media and to go for that short-term gain, to learn to be someone who is willing to express maybe the fact that they do love Taylor Swift and can sing Call Me Maybe on a podcast and lean into what makes you unique. It's why try and be the second best person of someone else when you can just be the best of you? The things that make you unique are what make you attractive. And it's scary. It's scary to lean into that. And I'd say that's the challenge that we will see of true, like authentic leaning into vulnerability. Because the biggest problem that's coming through that I'm seeing sort of work-wise is this like risk aversion that people have. And I think that's what's going to damage society the most, that it's a feedback loop of like the fewer risks you take, the less willing you're going to be to take the next risk. So certainly being that person that's able to be vulnerable and be courageous and take the risk. And that like, that could be for anyone sort of listening. It could be firing a text to the guy that you sort of really like. For a girl, it can be taking the first step, because this is something which is a reflection of modern day, that guys have now become a little bit more timid, but girls are still not really wanting to make that first move because of sort of the cultural norms around it. But speaking from the male perspective here, I've absolutely loved it when girls have actually made a move and taken some initiative and been interested in showing that. Like, for me personally, I absolutely love it when the girl shows interest in me. It's like, cool, okay, you're actually interested as well. I don't particularly like it if a girl is playing that colder role and sort of being too far in that realm of being like, oh, what isn't treating mean, keep him keen kind of thing. I don't like that. It's not, I want to know that you're all in. There's a Mark Manson quote that I love, and this should apply to everyone, and everyone should use this in their dating. So I do apologize ahead of time, but he uses this as, it's fuck yes or no. And that's how he operates, that if he's getting into a relationship with someone, that he wants to know that, do you want to go out on a date on Wednesday? It's like, fuck yeah, let's do it. And that's the energy that you want to have. Too many people get caught up in this thing of being like, oh, what do I text to try and get this girl to come out with me next week, and trying to do all these like nuancy things which aren't necessary if you meet the right kind of person. If the other person isn't excited to meet you and interested to be with you, and it is a fuck yes, then that means that maybe not right for you, and like, you shouldn't really be with them. Because too much of the dating industry is people operating and selling to men that are trying to convince someone to like them. It's like, how to get your ex-girlfriend back. It's how to get that girl to like you kind of thing. How to go from the guy that she doesn't like to the guy that she does. And fundamentally, that doesn't really work. It's a really good way to sell to people because you can sell them a dream, but it's not a good position to be in. You can't convince someone. You can only show who you are.
Well, I guess there's a little bit of tension in there, in that what a person might have to do is, yes, work on themselves, yes, improve themselves, but then having gotten to that point, they shouldn't be approaching another person with this attitude of, I need to beg you to like me. That actually, you know, whatever point I happen to be at right now, this is where I'm at, and it should be a point of, I guess, self-acceptance, and then encouraging that mutual acceptance.
You don't need to be perfect to get the girl. This is what I call the self-improvement trap of, I'm not going to put myself out there to meet people until this, until I've got the job, until I've got the six-pack. And what I tend to see that as is a way of cope and fear, because it's scary to put yourself out there. But you can always stay in the improvement trap. There's always a way you can get better. And this is super pernicious for guys, that they will just be like, oh, well, I could improve and then I'll get this kind of girl. It's like, no, you appear as you are, flaws and all. The most attractive person is the one that is self-aware of his flaws, is working on them, and is more than happy to express that he's not perfect. I failed at this so much in that first relationship, that I felt like I needed to be perfect, that if I was anything less than perfect, she wouldn't love me and she wouldn't be interested. And all that does is push people away. No one's interested in you if you're just Teflon Tom that everything bounces off. And if you can present yourself as real, that's so much better. And that's something that I always tell my clients to do, is just be real. They want to connect to someone that is real. It feels icky to connect to something that doesn't feel real and that is this kind of fake persona. Show them your flaws. That's okay. Be self-aware of them, because they're coming out either way, and it's better that you show them than you just let them bleed out and take her by surprise later on.
And also, don't deceive yourself into thinking that the other person doesn't have flaws, because when people fall in love, they classically project perfection onto each other. They project the ideal onto each other. And that's why the first, you know, 3 to 6 months of a relationship is so easy, because maybe you're not aware of the flaws, maybe you're aware of the flaws, but you can be willfully blind to them. But then sooner or later, you start to realize that that person has flaws. They start to land with you in a much more visceral way. And that's going to be the engine of the relationship, is how do we mutually negotiate with each other, flaws and all. So there's the self-acceptance, but then the acceptance of other, that's very important. And in my experience, people who are really harsh and judgmental on themselves tend to be really harsh and judgmental on other people. People who tend to be quite self-accepting tend to be quite accepting of other people as well. So this is like, just like a guy might be overly critical of themselves. When they get into the relationship, they might think, oh, the girl I'm with is totally perfect. And then if the relationship persists, when the flaws do start to come out, if they're still not self-accepting, then those flaws can be intolerable and the relationship can break down very quickly, actually.
That's a really good one to bring up. It's almost the pedestal issue that guys face that really put women up on a pedestal, that they believe them to be perfect. And it's often because they've been unable to accept that there are flaws in themselves and flaws in the women around them, that they just want to pretend to be perfect, that everything's perfect. They've elevated them to such a high status that, as you say, once you start to see those flaws, they reject them. And you phrased it better than I could, that the people that are able to accept the parts of themselves that maybe aren't that great, it's like it's a symbiotic relationship with how you accept others and how other people can present themselves. And I think that's something that girls will struggle with as well, like women will struggle with in modern day, where especially if you're a guy that's not as familiar with interacting with women and you've not had that many relationships, you're going to be ecstatic that this woman has turned up and you're going to project everything onto her, and it's going to be a lot of pressure. So understanding and accepting that you're flawed, everyone's flawed, we're all like broken people that are just doing their best to make this thing happen, is one of the best mindsets you can have to just be real.
Wise words. Andrew Wilkinson, thanks so much for coming on. I really enjoyed speaking with you. We're going to have you back at some point in the future.
I'd love that, man. This has been a blast.
Thank you very much.